You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. We hope you have a joyful Hanukkah and a Happy New Year.
CJSF 90.1 FM wishes you a bright winter solstice.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights on its 75th anniversary. If Britain and France had had their way, it would not have been universal.
People sometimes say it's a colonial document, but in fact, the colonial powers didn't want this document to pertain to people in the colonies. Britain and France actively fought against making it pertain to people in the colonies, but representatives from the colonies said, we want this document to pertain to everyone. It's simply not true that we're lesser beings and we can't enjoy human rights yet. So they were the ones that pushed for it, and that's how it got in.
Of course, lots of countries deny basic human rights laid down in the Declaration. Israel, for instance, in the occupied Palestinian territories.
Israeli military orders criminalize almost every aspect of a Palestinian life. The whole system is built so no true justice is given to Palestinians. There's no actual rule of law being implemented. You don't have any rights or any protection where you are living, and this is your homeland.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth News. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Today, Sunday, December 10th, is the 75th anniversary of the international community's most canonical human rights statement, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, promulgated by the UN General Assembly on December 10, 1948, in the wake of the horrors of World War II. The Declaration set forth what its drafters considered the most basic human rights all people should enjoy, regardless of race, religious creed, or nationality. Indeed, none of these human categories appear in the Declaration. The Magna Carta of Human Rights, Eleanor Roosevelt called it. I spoke about the Universal Declaration with Rhoda Howard Hassman. Hassman is Emeritus Professor at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Ontario, specializing in international human rights. Her books include State Food Crimes, The Human Right to Citizenship, Can Globalization Promote Human Rights, Reparations to Africa, The Age of Apology, and In Defense of Universal Human Rights. Hello, Rhoda Howard Hassman. Thank you for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about the Declaration briefly? Can you summarize for us what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was, what it is?
Well, what it is a normative statement about what human rights should be universally for all human beings. It's not a treaty. It doesn't have legal force. Many people think it is a Western document, but it is not. 56 independent countries were involved in writing the document. Many of those were independent non-Western countries, including all Latin American countries, Soviet bloc countries, India, which had become independent the year before, and China. The two blocks of, not even countries, but entities that were not involved were sub-Saharan African countries, practically all of whom were colonized at the time, and indigenous peoples, because it was a declaration by states, and indigenous peoples do not constitute formal states. Since then, however, there have been many, many more human rights treaties against torture, treaties against racial discrimination, women's rights, children's rights, rights of the disabled, and sub-Saharan African states and all other states have been involved in formulating those treaties.
These are nine binding human rights treaties that kind of emerged from the Universal Declaration.
Yes, that's correct. So when they're treaties, that means that when governments sign on to them and ratify them, they are legally obliged to uphold those treaties. Mind you, all of this is, as one scholar called, organized hypocrisy. There's not much that the United Nations can do. These are United Nations treaties. If a government decides not to uphold those treaties and not to adhere to their laws there. The other thing about the declaration is that many people think it only covers what are considered to be Western human rights, civil and political rights, such as the right not to be tortured, the right to a fair trial, the right to vote. Well, first of all, those are not just Western human rights. If you talk to human rights activists from places like Iran or the Uyghurs in China, they want the right not to be tortured. They want the right not to be executed. They want the right to vote. Secondly, the Universal Declaration includes what's called economic, social, and cultural rights. And that includes things like the right to work, the right to health care, the right to education, the right to a decent standard of living. Article 25 even goes so far as to talk about an adequate standard of living, not even a minimal standard of living, an adequate standard of living for all human beings. The civil servant at the United Nations who did the first draft was John Humphreys, a law professor from McGill.
So this was John Peter Humphreys who he wrote the initial draft.
Yeah, John Humphrey, before he drafted the first draft of the Declaration, did a study of all the constitutions in the world, including the constitutions of Latin American countries and Soviet bloc countries. And these constitutions included economic rights, such as the right to health care and the right to education. So he put those in the first draft to reflect the views of those countries. He also included cultural rights, the right to enjoy your own culture. And one of the reasons for that was that he was married to a French Canadian. And he was aware of the discrimination against French Canadians in Quebec at that time in the 30s and 40s. So it is simply not true that this is only a Western document, nor is it true that it is only pertains to Western people. I once heard a scholar from India talking about how people in India didn't care about civil and political rights, and she cited some women activists who were environmentalists in India saying that was much more important. So I said to her, you mean to tell me that it's okay in India for the police to torture, rape, and murder women activists? And she looked very startled. And I said, well, that's what you just told me. You just told me that civil and political rights didn't matter in India, that those are the rights that would protect, in principle, and perhaps even in fact, your women activists from being raped, tortured, and murdered. So these are myths. It is a document that was drafted by people from practically every region of the world except sub-Saharan Africa and representatives of indigenous peoples. And in fact, people also sometimes say it's a colonial document. But in fact, the colonial powers didn't want this document to pertain to people in the colonies. Britain and France actively fought against making it pertain to people in the colonies.
Did they actually do that?
Yes, they did. But representatives from the colonies, nationalists from the colonies, attended the United Nations and said, we want this document to pertain to everyone, including us. It's simply not true that we're sort of lesser beings and we can't enjoy human rights yet. So they were the ones that pushed for it, and that's how it got in.
And it's interesting that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, when you read it, the language is very sparse, it's very simple, and it makes nowhere is there any reference to a particular culture or political system or religion. It's a very universalist document.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's the product of months and months of debate and compromise among the representatives of various states. Also, I should mention, women's rights are in there. The right to non-discrimination as to sex, which was then meant biological sex, men and women. That's because of pressure from female activists and also from pressure from a separate committee on the status of women at the UN. So when it was drafted without language protecting women, the people who were in the committee of the status of women said, no, you've got to have equality for the sexes in that. Two of the other women involved in that, aside from Eleanor Roosevelt, were a representative from the Dominican Republic and a representative from India, I believe, women representatives. So they pushed for that to get in there. Also, the right to self-determination is something that the colonial representatives pushed for. There were African Americans representatives there trying to make sure that they were protected against discrimination on the basis of race, which is something the Americans didn't want to see in there because they were very busy discriminating on the basis of race.
I mean, which Americans opposed? Can you name names? Which Americans back in 1948 were saying, no, 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 don't?
I think it was more the government as a whole. Eleanor Roosevelt was a very fine person, but she was still representing the government of the United States, as well as chairing that committee.
I'd like to go through the Universal Declaration kind of bit by bit, but paragraph 3 of the preamble, I always find kind of interesting because it's sort of implicit recognition of the rights to resist oppression and subjugation in any way that's available. And it says, whereas it is essential if man is not to be compelled to have recourse as a last resort to rebellion against tyranny and oppression, that human rights should be protected by the rule of law. So it's kind of like an implicit recognition of the right to resist.
I'm not an expert on the what they call the preparatory documents, so I couldn't tell you what was actually discussed at the time about that. But you're right, it does say if you don't want people to rebel, then give them their rights. So you could imply, if they don't have their rights, it's your problem.
Let's talk about these various articles. Article 2 talks about no distinction shall be made on the basis of political, jurisdictional, or international status of the country or territory to which a person belongs.
That was because of people from the colonies pressuring to make sure that they were protected. But it does imply as well that if you are an individual in occupied territory, you have all these rights.
And then right to life, liberty, and security of person. No one shall be subjected to torture, to cruel or inhuman or degrading treatment. Equality before the law, effective remedy by the competent national tribunals for acts that violate fundamental rights. It's Article 8. Article 9 talks about arbitrary arrest, detention, or exile.
These are all the so-called Western human rights. But I've never heard of somebody who is an activist in the so-called Global South saying, I don't want these rights because they're Western. Go ahead and torture me.
Who are these folks or these entities who say this is a Western document?
This is, I heard once on the Canadian CBC, a woman going on about how this is a colonial document. These are people who think everything the West does is colonial. Colonial is now a catch-all phrase for the evil West. It was a standard argument as early as the 1980s when I started working on international human rights. For example, I once met an African man who told me that African women didn't need human rights. So I came home and I asked one of my master's students from the Zambia, a woman, what she thought about that, the idea that African women didn't need human rights. And she said, well, my brother-in-law beat up my pregnant sister. He killed her, but the baby survived and he got custody of the baby. So that's my answer to whether African women needed human rights. Now, of course, there are many African female activists in Africa that weren't in 1980, and they assert that they need human rights.
And then Article 13, the rights to freedom of movement and residence. Article 14, the right to seek and to enjoy asylum in other countries, the right to a nationality, the right to a family, to marry, the right to own property.
On the right to a family, some LGBT activists have thought that that's discriminatory because it refers to men and women. And it's true that at the time, probably nobody was talking about the rights of gay people to marry each other or same-sex marriage. What they were interested in at the time was the right not to be arrested because of same-sex sexual activity. But you could argue now that the men and women is anachronistic, and the more important part is the right to marry and to found a family, regardless of whether you're same-sex or heterosexual activity. Then the right to own property. Now, that was very controversial, and there was a lot of debate between, in this case, Western capitalist powers and the socialist bloc about that. And then the socialist bloc, or the Soviet Union, really eventually agreed to the phrase own property alone, as well as in association with others, claiming that Soviet policy, saying that all property was the property of the state, covered in association with others. Now, some people think that this is an unnecessary right. I have argued that it is necessary, at least for personal property. There are many countries of the world that deprive people of all their property, and they are very, very insecure. There are also countries that deprive peasants of their land. So one of the reasons for famine is that peasants are deprived of their land. The problem is, does this cover essentially capitalist property, the rights of corporations to own property? And there are countries especially where corporations are considered legally to be persons. Now, I disagree with that. I don't think corporations should have human rights. Corporations can have legal rights, but they should not be considered legal human beings. There's no international covenant subsequently on the right to property. So that's what's interesting. There is one on the rights of women, protection against racial discrimination, against torture, but there's no international covenant on the right to property. It sort of died. But when you think of this in part as a reaction against the Nazis in the 1940s, then you see why the right to property is there, because in Germany, between 33 and 39, Jews and other victims were deprived of their property, systematically deprived of their property.
And I mean, it's universalist. It makes no reference to any particular culture, religion, political system.
That's true. But some people, at least, had the Nazi period in the back of their mind and all the horrible things the Nazis did. Anyway, so to go ahead, if you'd like.
The right to take part in the government of the country, right to equal access to public service, universal and equal suffrage.
It says periodic and genuine elections, but not competitive elections. And again, that was a concession to the Soviet Union because they didn't want to have competitive elections. They were one-party states. So any elections that they had in the Soviet bloc were just pretty well a farce, as they are in many one-party states today. So that's, to my mind, a deficiency in this document.
Article 22, the right to social security, economic, social, and cultural rights. Article 23 talks about the right to work, the right to form and to join trade unions. Article 24 talks about the right to rest and leisure.
Now, again, that's been criticized, the right to rest and leisure, as being Western on the grounds that it, I don't know why, but it's also been criticized as frivolous, especially by a philosopher named Maurice Cranston back in the 80s. But if you think about it, how can somebody take a vacation if he's living paycheck to paycheck, or she's living paycheck to paycheck, and isn't paid to take that week's vacation or 2 weeks vacation? Also, reasonable limits on working hours, that's not frivolous. We're talking about in the West societies that used to have people working 12-hour days until the 19th century or the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And in the Global South, so-called, there are still people working 12-hour days, 14-hour days. So this is not frivolous. This is a reaction to the development of capitalist societies, societies in which practically everybody works for an employer, and that employer is going to exploit them unless they have protections.
But again, I think about people laboring away in fields and factories and across South Asia and up and down Latin America and in Africa, for whom rest and leisure. Well, of course, it's a biological requirement that we all have to rest or else we die. But the reality tends to be different in much of the world, in much of the Global South.
Yeah, this is a principle. It's a universal principle, but it's something people can refer to. For example, when they organize labor or organize protest movements, can refer to this and say, we want a shorter working day. Now, if it's your own field you're laboring in, it's a different matter. But much agricultural is now capitalist agriculture. So if you're laboring away as a agricultural worker, you may need these protections just as much in the Global South, or even more in the Global South than in the Global North.
Let's talk about Article 25, which is I think, close to your own heart and academic interests. Everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, yeah. First of all, the word adequate, right, which is more than, as I said before, than minimal. It's adequate. It means, it should mean things like you're not living on inadequate social welfare payments where you have to choose between paying rent or buying food, essentially, which is the situation in Canada today. Secondly, some of this reflects the thinking of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He's famous for talking about the four freedoms in 1941, freedom from want, freedom from fear, freedom of speech, and freedom of religious belief, I think they were. But he actually made a speech in 1944 proposing all of these other things, proposing that every American should have all these kinds of protections, which, of course, Americans do not have even now. So I think it's important to notice that you saw himself and his family. That's just an artifact of the 1940s. It has no meaning now. I used to tell my students, I want you to read this document and I want you to critique it. But if one of your criticisms is that it says himself instead of herself, I'm not interested. It's obvious and it's boring. The second part of this is also important. Motherhood and childhood are entitled to special care and assistance. And all children, whether born in and out of wedlock, shall enjoy the same social protection. Now, at that time, children whose parents weren't married didn't have the same protection as children whose parents were married. Also, motherhood and childhood implies, to my mind, things like universal paid maternity leave, which they don't have, for example, in the States. They still don't have it. They're way behind other Western countries. And I think universal paid maternity leave is extremely important so that mothers can be with their babies in the period of infancy and take care of them.
What's the situation vis-a-vis paid maternal leave in Canada?
If you are employed in Canada now, at least in Ontario, I don't know if it's universal offhand, you can take as many as 18 months off. You can get unemployment insurance, which would only be, depending on your income, a portion of your income, perhaps only a third, for 12 months. But if you want to, you can extend it for 18 months. So then you'd be getting a lesser period over 18 months. Your job has to be kept for you, and your seniority level has to be kept for you. So your employer cannot fire you for taking maternity leave. Contrast this with Sweden, which last I checked had 2 years of maternity leave, and with the United States, which has 6 weeks of unpaid leave for certain kinds of corporations, I think, depending on their size, only. So basically, in my view, as I've told many Americans who've interviewed me, the United States is an uncivilized country. Canada barely makes it as civilized, but the United States is definitely uncivilized.
Talk about the food part, the rights to food in Article 25.
Well, a lot of people think that that means the right for the government to provide you with food if you don't have it. And I think that's true. I mentioned the appallingly low welfare rates here in Canada at the moment. And you can go to newspapers now and every second day people will say, I'm living on welfare or I'm living on disability payments and I have to choose between rent and food. It's appalling. Canada has no national food policy. Millions of people are relying on food banks nowadays.
Article 26, everyone has the right to education. Article 27 talks about the right to freely participate in the cultural life of the community. Everyone has the right to the protection of the moral and material interests resulting from any scientific, literary, or artistic production. Article 28 is interesting. Everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration can be fully realized. This seems to get down to the nub of the problem, that we have this prevailing international order in the world today, which is really, one might argue, and I would argue, is kind of antithetical to achieving universal rights and freedoms.
Well, that's true. I just want to mention for Article 27, the protection of moral and material interests in scientific literature, literary and artistic production. I think that reflects the fact that a lot of the people who drafted this thing were academics. That's a legal right, to my mind. It shouldn't be a human right, and it shouldn't be in there. The social international order, you're quite right. That does say that there should be obligations not only by your own state, but by other states to protect your human rights. And that is a reflection also somewhere, I think, in the later documents on right to foreign aid. And it's also something that people who are involved in writing, people who were drafted a right to development in 1986, that was a covenant, not a treaty, can refer to. And now there is activity at the UN led by my colleague, Dr. Bonnie Ibawo, a Nigerian Canadian, to try to draft a treaty on the right to development. But I'd also like to bring your attention to Article 29, which says everyone has duties to the community in which alone the free and full development of his personality is possible. Now, leaving aside the personality for a minute, a lot of people criticize the declaration claiming that there's too much attention to rights and not enough attention to duties, and that it's too individualistic and doesn't regard the community. And in fact, there was quite a big debate at the time about what community meant and so on. So this is the result, this short thing that says duties to the community. There have been attempts since then to draft international declarations on duties, but none of those attempts disregards rights. And I don't think it's true that these are individualistic. I think that if you enjoy your human rights, then you're in a better position to help the community. Now, sometimes you don't want to be in a community. If you're a woman living in a community where women are subject to the authority of men, you probably just think it'd be better if you could just get out of that community. And there are lots of communities like that. Or you can change the community and get equal rights for women. But if you have enough to eat, if you have enough education to think or to be able to put your thoughts into words, then you are more likely to participate in the community than if you don't have those rights. Somebody living on welfare in Canada is going to be hard put to contribute to the community if she doesn't even have enough money to get bus fare. She might want to volunteer. And a lot of people do, even if they're very poor living on welfare. I discovered this in a book I wrote on civic leaders in Hamilton, Ontario in 2003. A lot of poor people would like to volunteer, but they don't have the bus fare to do it. So who volunteers in Canada? Many middle-class people who enjoy their human rights, many middle-class women whose husbands make enough money for them not to have to have a paid job. They raise their kids and then they spend the rest of their lives volunteering for the community, opening women and women's shelters, advocating for the homeless, all that kind of thing. So I don't think that human rights are too individualistic, nor do I think they neglect the community or duties. But it's true, there's no international declaration on human duties.
But again, getting back to Article 28, everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in the declaration can be fully realized. It seems to me that the international order today is founded on the pursuit of power and money and the ability to project power. Think about the international arms industry and the oil and gas industry and the fact that something like 1,000 or 2,000 people control 99% of the wealth on the planet. This is not an international order here on Earth, in which the rights and freedoms set forth in Declaration can be realized.
Yeah, you're quite right. The world is run by guns and money, basically. And it's not run only by Western guns and money. It's run by guns and money everywhere, right? Right now, for example, China is very busy exploiting Africa and exploiting African workers. Non-Western governments are just as abusive as Western governments used to be before democracy or some attempt at democracy, was introduced. You are quite right. So this is not only a statement about, say, the right to development, but it's also a statement about any exploitative business from any part of the world, and it's a statement about any abusive political group.
Can I ask you quickly, because we don't have too much time left, what does Article 30 mean, the last article? Nothing in this declaration may be interpreted as implying for any state, group, or person